But how do we connect the numerical relativity simulation of two merging neutron stars or black hole neutron star mergers? How do we connect this to the calculations that Almudena and Brian are doing? And so there's the question: we first need to understand what are the inputs that are needed for these simulations, and then also how can results or how can the simplified version of these simulations be actually included in the the things that are dynamically relevant for the post-merger evolution? How can that be included in the simulations? And how difficult are there easy recipes of connecting these two communities? So I would like to ask Almudena to say a few words about this, because she's obviously connected already supernova simulations with her calculations.
So we have done the calculations together with Brian post-processing, and since the energy generation could be important and should be implemented, we are constructing a table, or we will provide a simple routine to calculate this energy produced by the air process. And for that, we need to know, of course, temperature and density, but we need to have also some hint of the composition, because so we expect that from the equation of a state that you use in the simulations, we can get your average nuclei that we can use as seed nuclei. And I don't know, so I think it could be possible probably for you to track all this information for different particles. And then we will give as an output the energy generation and also how the composition changed, the average nuclei. This would be enough.
So the simulations need to be run with the nuclear, with the Latimer Sweci US or the Shannon US, with the nuclear US. And then what particles, what do we need to track? Is is that rho T Y E the only quantities that are needed?
Average proton number.
So.
And you will have neutron abundances.
So what is the average proton number? I thought that YE would give you that.
I mean, in the equation of a state, you have a representative nucleus. And for this representative nucleus, you have an average
proton number. The average
proton numbers, yeah.
The equation of state gives that, yes. And how is this, what is easy to do is in simulations is to put in tracer massless tracer particles that follow, the flow. But when you want to make an estimate of, how much of this and this isotope is produced, you want to have associated amount of mass with that. And how is that done in, our process calculations, for example?
So I think there are, two different points. One is the post-processing stuff. For that, one needs to follow the evolution of density and temperature in marker particles and have some initial electron fraction, and then we can post-processing calculate the exact composition. But what we were thinking about is to include this energy generation and approximate distribution of nuclei that runs together with the simulation. So implicitly calculate the energy generation. And for that, we will need some information of the seed nuclei at some temperature.
So that's something that's readily available already in the simulations.
Just wanted to clarify. It seems to me there's a significant difference between, say, tidally ejected and then some ejected from a disk or winds. With the tidal ejecta, maybe the dynamics separates. Numerical relativity just tells us the mass that's ejected. And then we can post-process to see what happens to it. But the neutrinative and winds or an ejecta from an accretion disk is a much more coupled problem. Is that right?
There are two issues here. One is concerning what Almudena was saying. I think one has to distinguish concerning energy generation two phases. One is when there are processes occurring where you need to have a composition which is evolving, and then from the point of view implementing in numerical simulations, our goal was to reduce that to the minimum amount of variables that you can still have a reliable estimate of the energy generation that it is what you need from the hydrocore. Now, from the point of view of doing the whole electromagnetic transient, there is also a late-time energy generation due to the decay of this R-process material back to the stability. But this is a problem which is much well understood, because this is the same problem we face in nuclear reactors on Earth. This is how the nuclear reactors cool down. This is something that has been studied. It is becoming politically not popular, but it is a problem we face when we have to close all the nuclear power plants. So this is, in principle, relatively well understood, and it is the same physics here. So now, concerning the issue of the winds, I think there are two issues here. My feeling is that for this tildely ejected matter, energy generation by the R process is more important, because you start with low entropy material that, due to the energy produced by the R process, it gets higher and higher entropy, and the dynamics may change by the nuclear energy produced. For winds, you start already with very high entropy ejecta due to the energy deposition from the wind, so then the energy produced by burning is normally a negligible effect in the whole dynamics. So the energy generation, my point is, will not be relevant for wind ejecta if you have in these events.
So, Brian, do you concur?
Well, maybe the zeroth old question is, what determines the mass that's ejected in the tidal tails, and can that depend on any heating or the dynamics of the material in the tidal tails seems irrelevant for that. Is that correct?
So perhaps somebody doing the merger simulation could comment on that.
I could say this is not from stuff I've worked on, but I believe a smooth particle hydrodynamic simulation by the group with Janka. Some of the ejecta is from the very cold tidal tail sort of thing, but there is also an amount of what's eventually ejected that comes from the interface when the two stars collide together in a binary neutron star simulation. And when that happens, you're going to have something that's initially at a crust density on very fast time scales, heated and smashed together, and some of these particles are the ones that eventually got ejected in that simulation. So I'm not sure how significant a component that is, but trying to understand all the physics, all the microphysics that's going into tracking those particular particles is probably going to be more nuclear physics than just what sort of spit off the ends tidally. So
right.
So
they asked then the question, the reverse question to the nuclear synthesis people. Do you just want to have the amount of mass and the average YE of the tidally ejected stuff? Is that enough to see what happens with it? Yeah, as post-processing. Right, if it's tidally ejected and unbound, it cannot have an effect. It's not going to have an effect of what's happening dynamically. So it would just be the average, the typical, the YE, rho T and YE of the ejecta. So that's something important to write down, because that's something that is already readily available in the data. We don't actually have to do anything. We can just provide the data. So that's an important thing to note.
Scaling is also important because let's suppose that a table becomes available where the energy generation can be included in the code, in the hydro code. In a post-processing way, we can do a much more fine estimate of the energy generation, and then one can cross-check that the energy that was generated in the hydro code was, in fact, correctly done.
So just for the sake of taking notes of this, this energy input is important for stuff that can fall back.
Yeah, so I just want to say, yeah, so this is, this heating is important at low densities. In fact, and it's slow heating, so it's only going to, so if you're talking about, you know, if you're talking about what effects it has on the fallback accretion, it's not going to be important in a simulation if you're only following the simulation for 10 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds or in a small grid. But if you're following matter to very low densities, on the matter that's unbound doesn't care, but the matter that's marginally bound is where this is important. So our approach was with Stefan, which we're looking at is to not actually follow this all in one simulation, but to include the heating as taking the outputs from a more compact configuration, determining what matter is ejected from the dynamically from the merger, and then having a larger hydrodynamic simulation that looks at what impact this R process has at low densities on what and when is returns to the black hole. And I think that when you're looking at the ejected mass, dynamical versus wind, I think that also are different questions. I mean, I think the dynamical ejected mass is something that's going to happen during the merger itself, probably is very sensitive to the GR and the EOS and all that during the merger. And then I think, you know, what's ejected in winds from the disk, et cetera, I mean, that in some sense also requires following the evolution for a significantly longer time scale. And this R process heating probably, as Gabriel says, I think it probably has most effect on the cold material ejected initially. If it's coming from a wind, it probably already has enough velocity to escape the system. So I think that the approach one should take is either just completely ignore the disk's winds and just look at the effects of our process on the tidal tails alone, treat that as an isolated problem, and then maybe look at these winds and treat that as an isolated problem. And who knows how they interact with one another? that's like the next step.
There was a point up there.
Yeah. Hello. I have a very naive question. If one wants to calculate any type of electromagnetic signature when it's opacities for photons. So are the opacities known in this region of the thermodynamic plane? So does it overlap, say, with opal tables? Or because otherwise it's very hard to know how much radiation comes out in the optical or in the infrared and so on.
So all the R process elements, there are specific lines known, which is how we identify them in metal-poor stars. But what forms the opacity in these events is a combination of many finer space lines, like in type 1A supernova, a dominant form of opacity are iron lines, and we know somehow all millions of them, but these have not been studied as extensively for these elements. Nevertheless, talking to people that do atomic spectroscopy, they tell me that the third R-process peak elements are transition metals, and they probably have a very dense spectrum of lines similar to iron, but that I'm just taking that on faith right now. I would guess that this is an order unity effect and not like
so the answer
a factor
is
of 10.
They're not well known.
No, the answer is they're definitely not well known. So we assumed iron in our calculations, pure iron. But at a minimum, you have like electron scattering and other things, so it's not like you're not going to see anything.
Your first point about the equation of state, I just wanted to be sure. Here we can deal with conditions of very low temperature, almost zero temperature. Is this a range covered by the equations of state or not? Just to put a number, it's 0.1 gigakelvin or things like that in temperature. Is this covered, for example, by Latimer's vesting?
0.1 MeV, so that's the gigakelvin. Right? That's the typical lower bound of the equation of state table.
So the lower bound in temperature
is typically 0.1 MeV.
So this is much higher than the temperatures we are talking here.
Yeah.
That was my thinking, that it may be out of the current equation of states.
Well, at much lower temperature, you're not in NSE.
So you don't have NSE. You have our process. There is no NSE.
Right,
our
right.
Process is not NSE.
Then you need to use a different equation of state. You can't, for initially, right, for running the actual merger simulation, material is an NSE.
Yes.
Then you drop out of NSE, and this is another topic that was brought up earlier, and that's one of my worries also, that you need to have some kind of way of transitioning from your NSE EOS to the low density, low temperature EOS, and have that self-consistently and allow it to go back and forth. So this is a good point. Non-NSE transition.
Where does that transition happen?
At a temperature of 0.5 MeV, typically, right? Is that correct?
It depends on the dynamics of how fast is the expansion or things like that. But I think here is not what worries me is not so much to have a correct transition, because in principle, the composition can be tracked, but for example, a table that provides you the energy generation and the change in composition. But what you need is a equation of the state that for an arbitrary composition that you put from the outside, you get the right thermodynamical variables.
I was just saying, I think he's worried more about the specific heat of these low densities. So they're following the composition, but they need to know if you inject X amount of energy. What pressure, et cetera.
At such relatively low densities, you treat the various isotopes as an ideal gas.
Right, I think that may be the answer.
Yeah, but there's also a problem if you want to follow the trajectory of the ejecta and you want to do this transition from NSE to non-NSE, you need to match smoothly, otherwise the hydrocoque blows up. You can't track. This is why I'm worried about this.
Different equation of a state, and we need to switch to a low density equation of a state if we follow evolution for several seconds. And then we get there some composition that we know is wrong, and we have to put our trajectories into the air process network to get the right composition. So I think in this case will be similar. The point here is also similar to in the supernova, that sometimes the alpha reactions produce some extra energy, and you need to add an alpha network to account for this nuclear energy. So here, the air process reactions already produce some extra energy that could affect your dynamics. And you cannot put a full air process network. So what we try to do is estimate this energy generation from these nuclear reactions. But in any case, to know the composition, we will have to go to a full air process network in a post-processing state, which will give us an exact composition in the same case as in the supernova.
So when you drop out of NSE, you obviously need to track the species. What is for then later on going on and doing more detailed post-processing modeling, what is the minimum number of species you need to be need to have tracked in the actual simulation code? Can you get away with just 7 alpha nuclei on top of YE and the neutron proton fraction?
Something one has to this. For example, this was Seitensal did take different marker particles and see how the post processing compares with the simple network that they had in the simulation. But for the air process, what we usually need is to have evolution of density and temperatures, and we start from nucleons, from NSE and nucleons, and then we follow the freeze out of NSC and everything. So in principle, density, temperature, and electron fraction is enough.
Okay. Okay. Is this list complete? Is that what you just said? Yeah, sure. Abundance of all these. Okay.
Quinn, the average changes.
Right. So how, you know, in the supernova community, there are various prescriptions of how to do that, right? So some people run an NSE network to populate, isotopes based on average A and C. And then there are simpler ways of doing that. But I think it's important to bring this to the attention of people doing the binary simulations that come from a very different background than the supernova modelers. And there has been not been, well, maybe Stefan Roswak, who is closer to the supernova side, has started doing that or has already done that. But I know of no full numerical relativity simulation that actually deals with this in any good way. So that's an important topic to keep on talking about. Okay, now I think this pretty much summarizes things. This will, of course, be on the web. Are there other points that people would like to make about this?
I just had a probably rather vague question, but from a numerical relativist point of view and thinking about the typical grid sizes that we have, especially when you have these unbound tails, is there a minimum grid resolution above which this sort of prescription doesn't make any sense? Essentially, a grid cell often in the unbound matter is going to be kilometers cubed, and we're talking about average numbers of particles inside a box that size. Does it make any sense whatsoever? That is a good question. I can give you an answer in sensible units quickly.
I mean, no, let's say the typical mass you want to resolve to be ejected is 0.2 solar masses. Mm-hmm. Your grid should be smaller than that, because then you will not resolve the ejected.
Yeah. So you think just resolving sufficiently, this won't make any difference to that? That was the... Well, some sort of multi-phase where you treat each of the different species as separate fluids, some sort of interaction at lower level. It'd be a horrible mess.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask about the transport. We've heard a lot about the heating rates that go in here, but what about the cooling rates? Are they adequate?
Well, I mean, if you do the simulation still with the polytrope, it doesn't make much sense to include the cooling rates. But
But the heating is modulated by the cooling, right?
Right.
And then you have the energy escaping in gamma rays.
So this is all very important to gamma rays. So at late times, when you're becoming transparent,
just going to say that during this entire region where the heating is affecting the fallback, this is all still very photon opaque. So the gamma rays are trapped, and I think the neutrino cooling is not effective.
But he has a point, because most of the energy is produced by beta decay that produce neutrinos.
No, that's
and of course we do not know the detailed beta strength distribution for all these exotic nuclei, so we face an uncertainty on the neutrino cooling rate that could be up to a factor 2.
So okay, so that's what you mean by cool. Okay, I was thinking like thermal processes, but yeah, so the So there will be some fraction of neutrinos that escape.
But that should be relatively simple to include, at least to get a decent estimate by, you know, a leakage scheme where you could even parameterize the optical depth as a function of density, just to see what happens. I mean, certainly the disk is neutrino cooled, so it will become thinner because of that. So, the question is, will this counteract this alpha effect?
So generally when the alpha particles are forming in my 1D calculations, the disk had already become neutrinos were already unable to keep up with other sources of heating in the disk. But when I was talking about neutrino cooling being effective, I was talking about thermal processes like electron-positron captures. I wasn't thinking about neutrinos being released by the beta decays, which I think are probably important at larger. I mean, certainly are escaping at larger radius, but I don't. But yeah. So neutrino cooling. If you're doing the disk simulation of this freeze out, you definitely should try to include neutrino cooling. But it's actually an interesting thing. You can show that the disk becomes thick. The condition that the disk becomes thick at late times, which is basically the condition that I see. It's been a while since I thought about this. But you can show that the condition that the disk becomes thick at times, that the quantum time scale becomes longer than the accretion time scale, is basically equivalent to the condition that the electron fraction is freezing out. Because what's cooling the disk are electron positron captures, but that's also what's changing the composition. So as soon as the disk is spreading faster than it can cool, which is the condition to become thick, it's also spreading faster than it can stay in equilibrium. So the freeze-out and the thickening of the disk occur simultaneously, and it was generally only after that point that we were seeing the alpha particle formation. So anyways, it should all be included ultimately.
Okay, so I think that was good. Now it's 12:15. It's not much point in going doing breakout sessions, so we'll postpone that to the afternoon. Again, if you have topics for breakout sessions, things that you'd like to see addressed by a few, you know, experts who get together and hash out problems, then that would be great. Let me know. The list I have down right now is this issue about the NSE non-NSE EOS matching that, you know, all the binary neutron star black hole people should be there, but then there are also supernova people who are not doing that. Certainly we are not doing that, and that's a problem. And then the other thing is something that came up also. Can we define a simpler set, a lower entry hurdle set of test calculations that let us compare multi-decodes? The Oakridge and Garshin group have done a really careful analysis of their 1D Boltzmann transport codes and how they perform. But how do we do this in multi-D? How can we do this at this point with various groups at very different levels of sophistication but addressing the same problem? So, some basic, for example, Thierry Foucault-Sassy toy model. Can we all simulate that and compare our results? So that's something I would like to see discussed in a smaller group. And then there was also this issue that was brought up by Jim on Monday, about the very large radii of the low mass neutron stars in the RMF model. Evan told me just a little bit ago that some people think this is just a symmetry energy issue, but also that could be discussed in a breakout session on equational state topics. So hopefully we get to this afternoon. Goal of MICRA is really to bring people together and solve problems, so perhaps we can make a step understanding at least the differences here. All right, so unless there are comments right now. There's one.
Given the fact that we are talking about microfishes, I see I think an interesting discussion will be, is there any microscopic, in general, neutrino interaction that needs to be improved? Or can one make a kind of ranking what are the most relevant and need to be mainly improved? I think this will be also interesting.
No, I think that's a very good point. And you're the leader of that discussion. All right. Yeah. There will be two talks this afternoon after lunch. The lunch break will be shorter. I can make this bigger. The lunch break will be shorter today because don't eat so much because we'll already have dinner at 5 for some reason. Didn't make the schedule for that. So at 2:30 we meet here. We have two talks. Chuck's talk that was moved from Monday, and Eric Schneider will talk something about the Einstein toolkit. And then we have time for breakout sessions. So this is a 2.5 hour slot, two talks of 20 or 30 minutes, and then we go off and have these breakouts. And hopefully at the end come back together, and then the chair of each breakout says a few words, you know, have one slide, basically the upshot of the breakout session. Yeah, we'll decide on the spot. There's lots of, you know, little areas where we can sit, and the biggest group probably wants to stay here, use the blackboards. All right, see you later.